from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, in the hour ahead, a 2013 Gallup poll found that 6 in 10 American voters would choose to get rid of the Electoral College and instead elect officials based on the popular vote. But like it or not, in today's presidential election, the next president of the United States will have to reach 270 electoral votes. And in this hour ahead, we'll refresh your memory about how the Electoral College actually works, and we'll hear why critics want it abolished or reformed. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In this Forum Hour, we turn our attention to the Electoral College as we get at how it works or in some minds doesn't work and how and in what ways it might be best reformed. And we'll delve too into its history and hear your thoughts and questions as we stand on the verge of the election of another president of the United States who will need the required 270 electoral votes to claim the highest office in the land. Joining us to discuss the Electoral College this Forum Hour here in studio is Jack Rakove, William Robertson Co-Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford. His latest book is Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. And Jack Rakove, good to have you back with us.
Yeah, good morning, Michael. Great to see you.
Morning to you. Lara Brown is also with us, and she's Associate Professor and Interim Director at the Graduate School of Political Management with the George Washington University. And welcome, Lara Brown.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And by the way, they're kind of on different sides of this, and we'll flesh that out in the course of, in terms of the Electoral College and what needs to be done with it and how it serves us or doesn't serve us, which we'll certainly get into in the course of this hour. But I thought I'd also begin, and let me do this with you, Lara Brown, if I may, with a kind of refresher course about what the Electoral College is, because contrary to many people's notions, it's not the popular vote that has anything to do, literally, with the constitutional election of the president. It's all about the Electoral College. And the fact is, you, I know, have been years defending it, and we'll get into that, actually changing people's minds with what I presume is gentle suasion. But give us a sense, if you would, of, well, what people need to know about the Electoral College and how it functions.
Well, there are actually a lot of aspects of the Electoral College that most people don't have a sense of. First of all, it isn't one college. What it really is a situation where you are casting your vote and your votes are counted through your state. So the Electoral College is essentially an assembly of electors in each one of the states that meet in the state capitals. And the choice that they make is really informed by the vote that you make. So I think that's kind of the first step, is to understand that it's not one giant meeting. It is a variety of meetings in all the state capitals in December where individuals in those states have been selected by their political parties, and your vote in your state informs which group of partisans basically get to go cast ballots for your state.
Let me use your metaphor, if I may, because Jack Rakove, who's here with us in studio, is wearing his Chicago Cubs cap, and we were commenting a little on the World Series. You said it's more like a World Series than a World Series than a Super Bowl. Yeah.
Well, that's correct. I mean, this is not my metaphor. This is a well-known metaphor that's used in political science to describe the fact that we do not essentially have one national vote. What we have are, if you will, 51 games that are happening simultaneously. Each state could be thought of as a different game. And generally speaking, the team that wins the most games, in other words, the most states, typically wins the Electoral College. And it is much like the World Series in the sense that it doesn't really matter how many runs your team has over the course of all 7 games. All that matters is that they've won 4.
And I ought to mention here that Steve Silverstein sent me something. He's been on a campaign with the Electoral College for many years now. Looking at the headline here, 2/3 of the presidential campaign is in just 6 states, because the electoral votes, of course, are in those states that are battleground states. And we'll get into that, of course, in the course of this hour. But these electors who are responsible, let's go to you on this, Jack Rakoff. I mean, they could go any way they want to go, really, literally, couldn't they?
In theory, they can. There's been, I think, a total of 157 faithless electors, as they're called, who have somehow voted in a way that was independently of how they were expected to vote on the basis of popular outcome. There's actually one or potentially 2 electors on the Democratic slate in Washington, the state of Washington, which will certainly go Democratic, who vowed never to vote for Hillary. There's one or two Bernie Sanders supporters up there who are hardliners, but it's never mattered when a faithless elector is voted. So there's no I think one probably has to assume that in the end they're constitutionally free to vote for whomever they wish to vote for, though in a number of states they are bound by state law to vote for the ticket they represent. But it's never been pushed in a moment when it would be decisive, when something would really pivot on it. We haven't really had a controversy on this. So it remains, I think, a bit of an open question as to what would actually happen.
Well, we have had a controversy about the college itself and how it operates, particularly vis-a-vis the popular vote. Back in 2000, people remember that Al Gore won the popular vote considerably, dramatically, by about 550,000 votes and lost in the Electoral College. Let's get some of the history of that from you. I mean, the difference between or the divide between popular vote and Electoral College.
Well, you know, the way I usually approach the history, and stop me if I'm going in the wrong direction here, is, but you know, since I've done a lot of work on the origins of the Constitution, I think it's worth knowing that the reason we adopted the system was not that it was the best alternative available; it was that it was the least unsatisfactory alternative available. That's to say, when the framers discussed the system back in, you know, the spring and the late summer of 1787. There were basically 3 modes of election they could use. You could have had a popular vote, and they discussed that actively. You could have an election by the legislature, by Congress, or you could wind up with the system we wound up with. And there were pretty strong objections against the first 2 alternatives. Objections against having a national popular vote and the fear they would be indecisive. Objections against having a vote by Congress unless he wanted to limit the president to a single term. So the framers came to the Electoral College system very late in their deliberations. I mean, it was pretty close to within 10 days or so of when they adjourned. There was a nice aspect of the Electoral College as they saw it, which was that the rules for apportioning electors among the states and then for having a contingent method of voting should the electors not produce a majority, those replicated the political compromises the framers had already reached over over representation in both the House and the Senate. But they defaulted, I think, on the key issue of determining who would the electors actually be. How would you know how electors were to be appointed? I mean, that was a matter that was left to the state legislatures. And there's actually a fair amount of experimentation in 1796, especially in 1800, changing the rules for appointing electors for purely partisan advantages. And if you want, I can go into that later. But, I think one key thing to understand and the conclusion I'm increasingly coming away with is that by virtue of defaulting so much of the responsibility over the appointment of electors and really the whole mode of presidential election to the states, we do have a kind of bewildering set of rules for determining exactly how electors will be appointed. Even though all the states but 2 use the same system, and also for resolving controversies that might arise should the outcome of a state's vote be in some question. And that, of course, was what came to the fore in 2000. You know, when some hundreds of votes seemed to separate Bush and Gore, and got into a kind of prolonged controversy with a lot of litigation between the state courts and the state legislature.
Ted wound up, of course, in the Supreme Court, and one can't help but sort of look at the winner-take-all sense of how the Electoral College works. I mean, if Florida, for example, has 2 votes today for one candidate or the other, all those electoral votes, theoretically at least, will go to the candidate who gets the most votes. Lara Brown, let's talk about that, because you've said that the framers wanted essentially geographical representation as much as population. And I think look with favor or approbation on the idea that the president, by dint of the Electoral College, has to be more mindful of the whole nation.
Well, I do think it's true that a presidential candidate has to consider a whole nation, because there is an advantage and an incentive to, if you will, win more of those, you know, sort of World Series games by a narrow margin than there is by running up the score in one of them. And this is where what we've seen over time is that this means that presidential candidates have to build a nationwide coalition and have to think about how they play as candidates in more than one region than, you know, sort of others. I also think, let me just say that Jack touched on something that is really important, which is the Electoral College itself is not necessarily the problem that many people have with it. I think what are sort of the larger problems are the party inventions, or the ways in which the two political parties essentially took over the Electoral College, realized that it was easier to game the Electoral College than it was the vote that would take place subsequently in Congress. And this was part of the lessons, and part of what essentially happened was that subsequent generations of politicians built upon the vacuum. And from that vacuum, we have a system that is certainly bewildering, as Jack suggested, but it is also fortunate, because one of the great news about having election controversies confined to states is that you don't have to do an entire recount of the nation. You know, Al Gore's vote over, his aggregate vote total over the total cast was essentially 0.5% of the vote. And in most states, that is a level that triggers an automatic recount. Now, if we had had to have recounted 100 million ballots, I can tell you that we would probably still be counting them. So there is an advantage to the fact that election controversies get contained to one state and move through the process at that point.
Well, there may be an advantage. In fact, Jack Rakoff, I wanted to go to you on this, but nevertheless, Maine and Nebraska have a proportional vote, and there are many who feel that it would be much more in keeping with the spirit of democracy if we had proportional votes versus the winner-take-all.
Well, okay, Michael, you have to distinguish proportional votes from district votes. And in the language of the Electoral College, that's a big distinction. You know, this is a long-running issue. People advocated having a district method of voting back in the early 19th century, the 18-teens and the 1820s. They continued to do so after the Civil War.
There's a big, I remember, in fact, an investigation under Birch Bayh back in 1966 of this whole question.
Right, yeah. And there was a big debate actually about the Electoral College in 1969, 1970, which was basically blocked by Southern senators for reasons that still remain somewhat obscure. So I have problems with Laura's position. I'm an advocate of a national popular vote. I would abolish, if I were the lawgiver in the 18th century sense of the term, I would abolish the Electoral College tomorrow. I would have a single national popular vote. I think if you did that necessarily, and you can do this in a sense under the time, place, and manner clause of Article 1 of the Constitution, we should be able to come up with the one optimal method of voting that I think would, relieve and really kind of, you know, take care of the anxieties that Lara and other people have fretted about, which is, you know, the idea of having a national popular recount does sound kind of scary. But then that's because in some ways we have such a bewildering array or diversity of voting systems. Of course, think about 2000. Think about the catastrophic role that Blake had her first name, Lepore,
the Florida registrar of voters,
West Palm Beach. So, you know, we have a bewildering array of modes of voting. I mean, that's where Democrats really lost the election. You know, I mean, I think many political scientists, maybe Laura disagrees on this, but I think many political scientists think that Democrats lost thousands of votes. Teresa Lepore, right, in West Palm Beach, as opposed to the hundreds that that separated them. So, you know, think about the bewildering array of voting systems that necessarily we have to use because we combine local, state, and, you know, national elections. But I assume if we had a national popular vote, there must be some one optimal way of voting that I think would relieve. And I can't tell you what it is, but I assume it must exist.
Well, you may not have relieved Laura Brown's anxieties. Laura Brown, let me go to you on this.
Yeah. Well, what I was actually going to say is that actually makes me more nervous because, quite frankly, this is precisely the conversation about whether or not the vote can be hacked or what it means to, in fact, rig the system. Right now, it is virtually impossible to rig our vote because we do essentially
not according
vote
to one
by
of the candidates, but
yes, but it is literally a virtual impossibility because you have to do it in so many places, in so many different systems, in so many ways that it is much more likely in our system that votes are essentially not counted out of accident or error rather than any sort of malfeasance or fraud. Were you to have sort of one national system, were that to all then be operated by the Secretary of State, which is an office that is appointed by the President of the United States, you could get into some, I would certainly argue, terrifying sort of political corruption, you know, at least allegations and possibilities.
Response, Jack Rakoff.
Well, I guess I would still want to say that, you know, the presidency is the single most important office we have that votes way differently depending on the states in which they're cast, that the existing system has lots of problems with it, including the whole phenomenon of battleground states and, you know, and the fact that there are very different incentives to vote as you move from state to state. And I don't think we should base the selection of the most important office in the land, and indeed literally in the world, on our fears of the worst case scenario that, you know, Vladimir Putin could somehow hijack, you know, the whole system. I mean, there, you know, I'm not a big expert on modes of voting. I'm just basically an 18th century historian. But I do think that there should be solutions available. And, you know, I also think, of course, that having a paper trail would probably offer, you know, one set of solutions to the kind of fears you've expressed. But it seems to me, and we should talk about this as we go on, there are many other reasons why I think having a single national popular election would be conducive to the well-being of the body politic. And so to ground the analysis on a kind of worst-case fear of how the thing could be hijacked as opposed to what are our best ambitions for how the president ought to be selected, it seems to me that just approaches it, you know, from the wrong angle. Although, you know, I understand your concerns, and I'm not dismissing them, but I would place my own preferences elsewhere.
Well, let me go back to you on this, Laura Brown, because I know there have been essentially Gallup polls and other kinds of ways of determining American support or lack of support for the Electoral College, and about 70% would like to abolish the Electoral College. Now, I know you've gone to some lengths to actually bring people to be more mindful of how the Electoral College serves us and got a lot of those numbers down with groups that you've worked with, focus groups. So, I mean, how do you convince people of the necessity of the Electoral College?
Well, let me just say there are a lot of aspects of the Electoral College that are much more nuanced from a campaigning standpoint. First, I think it's sort of erroneous to go back and look at national popular votes and then try to impute some meaning to them, in the sense that right now, all of the aggregated national votes that we have are just that. They are essentially an aggregation of the national vote, but because no candidate or campaign ever strategizes for national votes, what we really have is an accident of what occurs. So the idea that there is meaning in the 500,000 more votes that Al Gore got over George W. Bush is very difficult to say. Quite frankly, most you know, sort of analyses showed that those votes essentially came from California, my home state. I have nothing against California, but it came from California because California did go essentially in favor of Gore by such a large margin. Now that, you know, begs this question of, is it right that essentially California, the voters there with their perspectives there, should be the ones tipping the election? There are questions about that when we think about what it means for representation. Let me just also touch on the other aspect of the Electoral College that I think is really important, or at least
could I just intervene for just a minute here, Lara, if I may, because there's also concern about we didn't even mention the fact that Electoral College is based on congressional districts, and the concern is with gerrymandering.
Well, sure. I actually would not be in favor of the by-district method.
Right.
So the by-district method, and Jack kind of mentioned this, it's very different than proportional. By-district means that each state essentially awards an elector for each one of the congressional districts they have, and then whoever's statewide winner, they win what are the equivalent of the two senators' votes for that state.
Yeah. Well, you're going to make another point, though, in favor of the Electoral College.
Right. So a proportional allocation of electors would mean that, say, were Al Gore to win, 61% of the vote in California back in 2000 or whatever it was that he won, he would have then received 61% of the electors in the state. So I actually would prefer to see a proportional allocation of electors, and that would, in fact, incentivize the candidates to go more places. But
and again, that's true in Maine and Nebraska. What's wrong with that, Professor?
No, Maine and Nebraska do it by district.
I thought they use proportional. They use district.
No. It's district.
It is district. Okay, I'm glad we made that
distinction. For a long time, that was the preferred solution. Well, look, districts, the 18th century, you would represent a town or a county or a collection of counties. But districts, whether it's for the House of Representatives or, let's say, for presidential electors, are wholly artificial creations. They'd have to be designed by state legislatures, and they could take very gerrymandered forms. The city of Austin, Texas, which actually should have its own congressman, it's big enough, actually has no member of Congress because the Republicans gerrymandered the districts there so that Austin split up among four or five different districts. Look, I have a couple of big objections to what Laura said. So one is, it's a good point to say that, Gore's the bulk of Gore's national popular plurality is essentially a California vote. But so what? Laura seems to like a kind of geographic basis of think about representation. And I think that's wrong. I think people in California, we don't vote on the basis of being Californians. We vote on the basis of having a set of political sympathies that we actually share with voters across the country. We may care about the Second Amendment. We may care about a whole array of environmental
issues. We're a blue state, though.
Well, we have to vote that way because that's the way the system is gamed. But the emphasis that she's placed on a kind of having a geographic principle of representation, I actually think that's misplaced. But the second point—
abolish the Senate?
Well, yeah, I would abolish the Senate, too, in fact.
Right. On that rather provocative remark, I'm going to have to break in here and invite callers to join our discussion. We're trying to understand the Electoral College and hearing a debate on it. And it's a pretty, as you can imagine, strong debate. So feel free to join. We'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now by calling that number with weighing in or questions or comments you have about the Electoral College. Again, 866-733-6786. A lot of people writing in as well, and you can do the same by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Join us with Jack Rakoff and Lara Brown. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to the Forum program on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about the Electoral College, and Jack Rakoff's here in studio with us. He's William Robertson Coe, Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford, and his latest book is Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. We also have Lara Brown with us, who is Associate Professor and Interim Director at the Graduate School of Political Management, George Washington University, and we're going to go to your calls and emails. Lots of people want to weigh in here, and lots of people have questions, and we'll take as many of your calls and emails and postings as we can, as well as tweets. Let me go first to Jack Rakoff, though, because he had a second point, which I wanted him to finish before we hear from you. Jack.
Right. So the second point I want to make about a national popular election goes to the point that Lara was, in effect, raising, that, if there is an enormous disparity in the proportion of the electors who vote, and to some extent based on how competitive or how much of a battleground the state they live in happens to be. In 2012, I think Minnesota, 76% of the electorate voted in Minnesota, 44% voted in Hawaii. But to me, one of the great advantages of having a national popular vote is it would destroy the phenomenon of the battleground state. And I think it would give the political parties an enormous incentive to mobilize their voters wherever their voters existed. Republicans have no interest in turning out their voters in Idaho or Wyoming or Montana. Democrats really have no interest in turning out their voters in California and New York because those are not battleground states. If we had a national popular vote, parties would have to re-strategize how they would want to mobilize and recruit their voters. But if you assume that the race is competitive, and I think in some ways national popular vote would be to the Republican advantage more than the current structure of the Electoral College. But if you assume that the race is competitive, parties would have a strong incentive to mobilize their votes wherever their votes were cast. And I think doing that would be a net public good for the American Republic.
Well, let me read a comment here. We're getting a lot of questions, but I'll start with a comment from a listener named Mike who says, we must be very, headlined, careful about amending our cherished Constitution. That said, in this age of instant communication, the Electoral College has served its purpose and has worn out its welcome. It's an anachronistic process that interferes with modern democracy. Time to put it to rest with the hero's honors. And here are some questions, and let me go first one to you, Lara Brown. Philip asks, how are a number of electors that each state gets calculated, and how does that affect the influence of big states versus small states, rural versus metropolitan, north versus south, etc.?
Well, one of the things that's very interesting is that the number of electors a state has is equal to their congressional representation. So it's the number of House seats they have plus their two senators. So California has 53 House seats. It then has two senators. It has 55 votes in the Electoral College. That makes it obviously very strong. And quite frankly, when you look, essentially the larger the state gets, right, the sort of less the two senatorial votes matter. So really, at the end of the day, what we're talking about is it gives the state essentially the weight that they have in Congress, but it gives it to them nationally as though both chambers were essentially joined.
Question.
And I think, one of the things I just want to mention that Jack brought up is this idea that somehow all states would mobilize. They really wouldn't. I mean, one of the things that's so important is to understand how campaigns are run and how decisions are made and how parties actually work, in the sense that the parties are still going to find the places where they could maximize their vote. They're still going to find the places where they essentially could run up the totals. And what that means is they're probably going to do less retail politics. They would spend more time at airports at giant rallies and less time, in fact, with people. But more importantly, and one of the things I think many people don't understand is if all of a sudden the entire country becomes competitive, there is a reality that the cost of our elections probably goes up four or five times because you're now not just focused on battleground states. You're focused on 330 million people with about, 250 million or so registered voters and typically about 130 million that'll turn out.
But Jack Rickle.
I see that as a net good. I mean, it seems to me civic engagement is something we want to try to attain as opposed to saying, look, today, what are the battleground states today? Essentially, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Nevada, and Florida. The rest of us, I voted this morning. I got up early because I had to drive into San Francisco to see Michael and appear in this program. And really, I have no incentive to vote. I assume two things. If you have a national election, the parties are going to have to adapt and electoral strategies are going to change. But they are, since a vote is a vote is a vote, wherever it's cast, they will try to maximize their output. Now, it's said that, okay, the expense, the amount of money spent on media is going to get more complicated, et cetera, but that's a very dynamic situation. We know from the growth of social media And we also know that it's not clear how much big television advertising is really worth in terms of how it affects public opinion. I think the parties will come up with a variety of strategies. You know, it's not going to be expensive to recruit voters in Idaho. You know, media time doesn't cost anything there, but also you have alternative media available. So no doubt there'd be a big adaptation process that would take place.
I got to tell you,
I think it would be good.
I was in Ohio last weekend and inundated with ads. You know, you couldn't turn the TV on or hear anything without ads. California, you know, they're not spending much money here because it's a foregone conclusion. I go to a question for you, Jack Rakoff. Stephen writes, if no candidate wins a majority of votes in the Electoral College, do the electors get to vote in a second round or does it immediately go to the House of Representatives?
No, it immediately goes to the House of Representatives. And so, you know, what Lara said earlier, it's not Electoral College. I always think it's a bunch of departmental faculties and they vote once. And they pass their votes on. And, you know, this is a big issue in Philadelphia. I mean, it's actually kind of a funny story because the committee, I won't go into all the details, but the committee that that proposed the changes was trying to kind of combine the prior compromises over representation, meaning the three-fifths clause relating to the House and also the equal state vote, which I personally detest, for the Senate. But originally they said, because they want to propose it, the contingent vote should take place in the Senate. And the problem was the same committee also came up with the proposals that link the Senate and the president more closely together. That's to say, the advice and consent clauses that relate to treaty making and relate to appointments. And the framers wanted the president to be independent of the Senate. So if you made the Senate the contingent elector, then you'd assume the president would be politically dependent on the Senate, which they wanted to avoid. And the funny thing is the framers kicked this around for 3 days. They couldn't figure out a way to get out of it. Eventually they voted for it. But then Roger Sherman from Connecticut says, wait a second, I have a solution. And Hugh Williamson from North Carolina, let's have the election go to the House voting by state. So you preserve the equal state vote, but you get rid of this kind of separation of powers question about the relationship between the president and the Senate.
All right, as long as we're talking about the framers, I want to go to another question from a listener, and I want to get to your calls here as well, so hang on the lines. But Bill writes, I can see why the framers of the Constitution may have rejected the system of Congress voting for the president, since it sounds similar to the way the British Parliament chooses their prime minister, but I still don't understand what serious objections they had to a popular vote.
Well, the serious objection, there are two serious objections to a popular vote. The first one was if we have a single national constituency, the South becomes a permanent minority. Because slaves would have no political presence. You can factor them into a scheme of apportioning representatives, but slaves are not citizens. They're not legally, they're not even people. They're simply, you know, considered as objects of property. So there's that issue. But I don't think that was the decisive one. Madison raised that point, but then he changed his mind as the convention went on. I think the really decisive one was that it would be very hard to imagine how you would form anything resembling a national popular majority in a post-George Washington world. I think the framers assumed that you'd have a lot of favorites on voting, you know, kind of provincial regional voting, maybe the kind Lara likes, I'm not sure, and it'd be very hard to get to a majority. And the great irony here is as soon as you get to a contested election, 1796, and then again the replay in 1800, where it's essentially Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, a national popular vote would have worked, would have been effective, would have been decisive at that point. So what the framers could not anticipate in 1787-88 became really a political fad.
We won't even mention the Tills-Hayden Compromise, because that plays in here as well. But I want to get a response from you, Lara Brown. But first, a question from Ben that I'd like to toss at you, if I could. Does the Electoral College, Lara Brown, prop up or help maintain the two-party system?
Well, certainly it does help to prop up the two-party system because one has to earn a majority of electoral votes in order to win the presidency. And one of the things that the Electoral College does is, in fact, allow essentially a magnification in most instances of the popular vote. So it provides the new president typically a larger electoral vote majority than they essentially have at the popular vote level. The only time there have been misses is when the country is essentially at 50-50 anyway. And frankly, as somebody who has studied a lot of different election methods, there's really no good method when you are at 50-50. All of them are sort of subject to problems. And The second thing that I think is important to kind of understand about this geographical representation, I do actually think it's important. I have lived in five states. I am, you know, a Californian by birth, but I've lived all over the country. I've traveled to 47 of them. And I can tell you, we have very different political cultures. And I don't think that one can just say it's all about national interests. I do think that it matters if you are somebody from Vermont or Rhode Island and you do think differently about your politics than you do if you're in Idaho or in the West, for that matter.
All right, I've got a lot of callers lined up here. Do you want to say something, though, quickly, Lara Brown, about why the framers may not have opted for popular vote?
Well, I mean, I just think that obviously there were logistical problems. That was a piece of it. There's also the fact that when you look at the sort of decision that was made, it really did, you know, as Jack mentioned, essentially reflect the Connecticut Compromise and essentially what the framers decided for the Congress itself. And when you look at sort of their perspective, I think what they were hoping was that the Electoral College would essentially be the nominating process and that then the congressional vote would be sort of the general election, if you will, in our terms.
I want to get to as many calls as we can here. Let me begin, Jim, with you in Fairfield. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. You've been skirting around this this issue, but I wanted to point out how unfair the current system is to Californians, that because, as Laura said, the impact of adding the two senators is small for the larger states, but it's huge for the smaller states. So my vote here in California has 1/18 the impact of someone in Wyoming or New Hampshire or in a really small state. That is, if we have this principle of one person, one vote, that would apply if we had popular vote. It does not apply. My vote is a fraction of somebody from a small state. And this came up earlier in the conversation that George W. Bush had 500,000 fewer votes than Al Gore and won the election because of our current system. That's because the current system of the Electoral College disenfranchised my vote as a Californian. The argument against making a change is that the smaller states would be less important, especially less important to the early part where Iowa and New Hampshire have a huge impact on the election. But the current system, if it's less fair to them, the current system is really unfair to California.
All right, Jim, get the point, and I thank you for it. We'll let it stand because I want to get more of your calls on here. Let me go up to Sonoma next. Logan, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. So I just want to make the point. You guys talked a little bit earlier about does this cause a two-party – does it further the two-party system? I think both ways, if you're talking about equal distribution of vote state by state or a national policy or a national vote force a two-party system, but I think what you need to do is change the first-past-the-post system of voting, because right now a lot of people are voting just to make Jill Stein hit a 5% chance, but if California's electorates were equally allocated based on the percentage of the popular vote in that state, then people wouldn't be as apt to do that, and it would further kind of remove the chance of a third party having success.
What do you think, Jack Rakoff?
I'm pretty skeptical about that. I mean, it seems to me, I agree with Laura. I think the presidency is the real reason why we have a two-party system. I think if we had a parliamentary system on the British model, we'd probably look more like Italy. It's a big country. I'll yield to Laura on its geographic diversity. I think we'd have a lot more regionally based parties, and you'd have get into some form of coalitional politics. But I think so long as the presidency exists, it places an enormous imperative on having two candidates, occasionally a third-party candidate. You know, I think Ross Perot back in 1992 will have some kind of ephemeral impact. But I think what's happened to Jill Stein and also the guy from New Mexico who doesn't know what Aleppo is.
Johnson.
Johnson. That in effect, the closer you got to the election, you know, the more those voters are likely to go with one of the two mainstream candidates.
Lara Brown?
Well, I mean, let me just say a couple things. One, on this 1/18th issue and this sort of one man, one vote, that is actually not our system. And this is one of the things that always frustrates me, is that that description was a description of what came down in a Supreme Court decision in relation to the House of Representatives. It had to do with malapportionment and the fact that within your federal voting, it is true that when you vote for the House of Representatives, your vote is one man, one vote. But that is not actually the case in the U.S. Senate, which is why I brought it up. It is also not the case, certainly, for the Supreme Court. You have no say in the Supreme Court because, obviously, the president nominates and the Senate confirms. So what is always a little bit frustrating to me is that our system is not based upon sort of either a parliamentary structure or a structure that is a national structure in and of itself. So I always feel like this conversation around the Electoral College ends up really being about, you know, if we're willing to completely change the entire political structure of the United States, then really we should consider it. But when you think about what our structure is and how federalism is an active component of our country's sort of history and one of the principles upon which our politics operates, then I do think that one needs to kind of put this into a grander context. Secondly, I brought this up before, but I think it's something that is so important to be understood. The aggregate national vote of what we have right now is not meaningful in the sense that no campaign has ever run a strategy to try to acquire the national popular vote. What that means is it's like playing a basketball game and at the end of the game deciding you shouldn't count any of the points that come from free throws. If you do that, then you realize that the entire last few minutes of a basketball game are not at all going to run the same way that they were played as though free throw points mattered and counted. In other words, we can't keep imputing meaning to the fact that one candidate had this and another candidate had that when that has never been the party or the candidate's strategy to acquire it.
All right. I want to bring more callers on. Hugh, thank you for waiting. Hugh, you're on.
Hi, thanks. I have a question about alternatives to winner-take-all voting, which it seems to me are really important because there's so – under that system, there's so many voices that are just shut out. So the Green Party is at currently 2%. If it somehow miraculously was to increase tenfold, you'd have a 20% of the vote, but they still would have zero chance of actually winning an election because we have this first-past-the-post system. So I think we need to shift away from that, and I wonder what are the alternatives, whether it's proportional representation or ranked choice voting, or what way we could do that with the least amount of heavy lifting in terms of changing the Constitution.
Larry Braun?
Well, I mean, one of the things that is actually happening in Maine today is that they are passing an initiative to do preference choice voting, which basically means that when you do vote, you get to vote not just, you know, for one person, you get to rank people. And what that means is that if your favorite person doesn't essentially come in the top, those votes will be reallocated to essentially whoever was your second choice. And one of the things this does do is start to change the nature of how campaigning happens. Candidates start trying to be everybody's second choice because, in fact, that is one of the better ways to win. And I think, you know, I agree. I would like to see some more competition among parties at the other sort of more popular vote levels. And then what happens is that roll up to a system whereby those electoral votes were essentially proportionally allocated. And I think you could end up with a very representative system in and of itself.
And again, Lara Braun is associate professor and interim director at the Graduate School of Political Management, the George Washington University. Jack Rakoff is William Robertson co-professor of history and American studies and professor of political science at Stanford and the author of Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. And Jack, you spoke before about slavery. You've been getting a lot of comments about how that fits in here. In fact, I'm looking at a tweet from Carl who says, "So again, the nation's good intentions are warped by slavery. We need to understand our history, electoral college and all." Gotten several comments making, again, the tie. Perhaps you can shed some light on this.
Well, it's something I've written about extensively. So slavery is part of the original political equation. It's an issue that the framers of the Constitution confronted up to a point without wanting to abolish it. It is incorporated, under the original Constitution, both in the allocation of seats.
It's also part of the compromise of what gave us Electoral College.
And it's replicated. And look, there's an interesting argument here about what happened in 1796 and 1800, particularly in 1800, where it's sometimes argued that the reason Jefferson won the presidency in 1800 actually reflects the significance of the three-fifths clause in terms of the overall, the different rules of voting.
Blacks should be counted as three-fifths of a person.
It's a total population.
What's the total?
No, it's not males. It's just, just personhood. The problem with that is, and actually Larry Kramer at the Hewlett Foundation, I have written about this once, is that, in fact, in 1800, the states changed a number of rules. Because they were actively manipulating their, for partisan purposes, the basis on which electors would be appointed. So that, for example, Virginia had a district system in 1796, and they lost a single elector based in Richmond who voted for John Adams. So Virginia in 1796 went to a statewide winner-take-all system. Massachusetts had a district system. They went to having statewide legislative election. So slavery was a factor, but the key thing about the Electoral College is because so much authority devolves upon the state legislatures, a whole number of rules were coming into play. Of course, the other great example of this, Michael, is to think about 1860 and Abraham Lincoln's victory, which is basically the immediate political cause of the Civil War.
Here's Rebecca, who writes, "I agree with Jack Rakoff that fear should not be the motivating factor against a national popular election. I imagine there are successful examples of national popular voting systems from other countries, Jack."
That seems to me to be the case. Other nations, like I think France and Brazil managed to, managed to have a second election if the first election, let's say 2 weeks later, the first election doesn't reach a majority.
And Lara Brown, looking at a comment from, or actually a question from a listener named Elaine, who says, "What do panelists think about vote swapping in relation to the Electoral College?"
Well, it's a nice gimmick. I'm not sure, how effective a solution it's going to be to larger issues.
Let me bring another call. Go ahead, Lara Brown. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I certainly think, it exists. I don't see it as being in any way sort of, a negative. I tend to also think that people's involvement with their party and their involvement in national issues does give them representation in other ways. So I don't think that we are, as a country, sort of at a loss for ways to be involved or ways to participate. And let me just also say that California, because you do have 55 electoral votes, you are actually very important, even though this year it may not be a battleground. Certainly without it, no Democrat could essentially put together an electoral college majority right now.
Well, here's Adam who writes, "I've long been partial to the Electoral College, but something Lara Brown said may have ended that partiality once and for all. Her comment that the Electoral College makes sense because otherwise 500,000 people in California would have been responsible for Al Gore's election is utterly bewildering to me. That means that because I live in California, my vote for Al Gore wasn't as important as someone else's in another state. I'd like for your guests to shed a little more light on that thought."
I'd really love to answer this in agreement because, I guess I fundamentally disagree with Laura on the geographic significance. I don't deny that states have multiple political cultures. Look, I'm a native Cook County Democrat, and I'm proud of it, and I understand, for better or worse, how Illinois politics operates. But I happen to think that when we vote, we're not voting primarily on the basis of the state in which we live, and we're certainly not voting on the basis of the size of the state in which we live. One point that's been skipped over, what we kind of talked about it somewhat indirectly, is the senatorial bump, the idea that the smaller the state you are, the more your individual vote will weigh, seems to rest on the idea that if you live in a small state, then you deserve some additional political protection because otherwise you're going to be outnumbered. That might be true if you ever voted on the basis of the size of the state in which you live. But in fact, we never voted. I'll just say never. We never vote on the basis of the size of the state in which we live. We never ask what's good for large states, what's good for small states. If you care a lot about the Second Amendment, maybe that's the decisive issue. If you care a lot about the environment, maybe that's the decisive issue that affects how you vote. If you're just a basic liberal the way I am, that affects your political attitudes. The idea that we have a system that recognizes size in this perverse, inverse way when size is irrelevant to our political preferences strikes me as being downright perverse.
Well, I'm looking again at the fact that 94% of the 2016 events, 375 of 399, were in 12 states, campaign events. Right. 11 states identified as battleground states by Politico and The Hill. And there we have, I think, come to the end of this hour, alas. You'd like to just quickly, in seconds, if you could, Laura Braun, you'd like to reform the college, though, although you stand
well,
by
it. Well, I would.
Like,
but, yeah. And this is, again, you know, at the end of the day, I would like to see the electors be allocated proportionally. That's not going to happen because what it then means is that the parties would be competing for one or two additional electors in each state rather than for the whole cache of, say, one state's, you know, full slate of electors. That said, let me just say that I really sit where Alexander Hamilton argued in Federalist 68, which is that, you know, if not perfect, it is at least excellent.
Well, he did say it was a moral certainty, too. But let me leave it at that, and let me thank both of you. Laura Braun, again, is Associate Professor and Interim Director at the Graduate School of Political Management, George Washington University. Good to end with Hamilton. Think about all that Broadway pizzazz. And a lot of Broadway pizzazz today, probably, as this goes underway. Jack Rakoff with us, William Robertson, co-professor of history and American studies and professor of political science at Stanford. And his latest book, again, is Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. Thank you all for listening. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny. Go and vote if you haven't.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.